Thank you. finish up the conversion section. We're going to start on the Sora, hopefully today. But right at the tail end, I went through the different versions. Most of them are on file 5 on page 2. There were a few others that I didn't mention because they're really the direction set through it, so they're not important. So this would be under other versions. And we're talking about the Armenian, Gregorian, Gothic, Arabic, Ethiopic, and probably the Coptic, although I gave them Coptic separate, but the question whether it's derived from Septuagint or not, because it's some of the early ones, I gave them separate. These usually are lesser value protection criticism than the others. And UDF would be more than UDF, but for the purposes of what we can use them for, they're farther down the line. Now, the English version, later English version, talks about what translation we use, the version, the translation of the version, and these others are for English. What are the cross-references? File 23, 25, and 27 on the manuscript translation file. And that's already cross-referenced on the file index I gave you. So, look up the index and see those. These are just evaluations of the translations that we're doing in that class.
Where are those files?
File 23, 25, and 27.
Question. What was the after Armenian was what is how do you say that? Not Gothic, if you want to call that?
Gregorian.
Gregorian? Is that on the field?
Well, I don't believe it's on there. There's not all of them are on here. There's others. If you look in front of the UDF, it's probably.
Oh yeah, it's G with a G.
Gregorian. Yeah, G-R-E-G. It looks like Gregory.
Yeah. Yeah.
Later English version. The ones I've given here, I just put a few here that I feel are important. I'm sure no one has a different opinion, but number one, it has to be Rothman, particularly since he gives you a lot of notes with regard to the Masora and Ginsberg's comments in the version and the fact that he shows you use of graphics and emphasis that brings out that aspect of the people that can be out there. I love the good literal translation. And after that, it's kind of a toss-up. NAS is good. NIV is good for different reasons. NAS is active in most places. Some places it's more active than Rothman. Some places it's really inactive. It's inconsistent places. I think theology played a role in who did what section. So the scholarship varies in life. The one man effort, Rothman, is really incredible. The NIV is good. That's brand new on the Old Testament. It's not good all throughout. I haven't had a chance to check it throughout, but it does try to keep the sense of Hebrew by paragraph instead of just the traditional verse division, which it gives, but it tries to restore somewhat the sense of the Hebrew a little bit, and their philosophy, their editorial philosophy, was to try to get people to look at this the way I went to a seminar with this guy telling me to go scripture rather than sit scripture. And in an effort to try and pull in context rather than have people pull out verses out of context, so they do give a little bit better presentation of the format. The accuracy is not any better than Rothman AF, but it's sometimes some places it's worse. But it's just good to compare it, especially since it's brand new. It does bring out meaning of some words that were in question in Rothman.
So, question here, another way to translate
you evaluate as well use of the language, in other words, like certain translations, like anything out of like Lacania, that you don't get the flow or the beauty of the language there. You miss the meter and the rhythm of the Hebrew. It's totally absent. And you don't read the Psalms and you just kind of like, you know. And so, whereas in the NIV, you find that they do. They deal with that a lot, and they do a fine job in many ways. Do you consider those things well in your
study? Yeah, that's part of what I was just mentioning about the NIV. That's why I consider it valuable. Because the Hebrew mind, the way they speak, is one of the most important things that they say. Like the reason that there's an article I read at the time and all these kinds of things where the diplomats from the Arab countries and underneath that puddle, because our conversation is basically, you know, about 5 feet apart. There's 2 feet apart, they can see your eyes. They're so good at telling your line that the iris of your eye actually dilates. And so it's probably one of the reasons why but they try and be vague on purpose, so you don't know for sure what they say, and so they look at each other's eyes like themselves. Anyway, the NIV does somewhat restore a sense of but NAS, on the other hand, gives you options in the columns a lot, and good cross references, and that's kind of fun that way. So, for that, it's good. Lots of things that you can do, NAS is a little more about. Probably the best cross references in the Marx theological view. And he's word studies and college studies for a long time. It's just the King James. But if you didn't have the classes in the Old Testament, say in the minor prophets of Jeremiah, you could get by pretty nicely with the word studies and various archaic meanings just by the study of the study Bible, they get a bonus head and bonus. Of course, they also have an incredible index in the back. And since he was one of the brethren, his theology viewpoint is closer to ours than our brethren. He does use the cross reference scriptures that you know people have asked. Young, which most people really like, but I don't. These are all subjective opinions, but I just don't know. But I'm looking at it from a language point, more so an accuracy point, more so their use of somebody else's language. The reason I don't trust them is good in a lot of things where he uses the imperfect, right? But I'm not sure that whole approach is right. Also, he takes a lot of liberties with measuring that he tends to make his own person in his own place. For the most part, he's very literal, but he does have his own very dogmatic opinion. The concordance, as far as they've done in the Old Testament, is excellent, but it's very liberal. They use the Septuagint a lot. There's one other work here that's good in the Poetic Book, and that's the Old Testament Book of Poetry, the 26th translation. They give you the all Poetic Books of the Bible, and where the different ones differ, they will give you different. Similar to the one in the New Testament, this is the Poetic Book of the Books of Poetry, the 26th translation. And it does include the Septuagint and the Shiva in it. So it's handy for that. You've got, remember, just on the Poetic Book, the one book, you've got what the Septuagint says in the verse, different from
after it starts to melt. There's the rest of them fall down the line from there, except for Jay Green. Green's in the winter, it's a good literal translation for the most part. It does vary in place. And it shows that Calvin's advanced in place, but it's by and large, it's pretty good. I think the translation, you know, in the city philosophy is very complex. He has a very archaic approach in the past, but it's the only thing so far to understand is about a third of the way through there. Okay, I have one more category here on quotations. Of course, still talking about introduction to the Old Testament. And this is quotations in the New Testament. Quotations in the Mishnah and Midrash. The mission we talked about has a copy of that for Akiva, Abba, the oral law. And the Midrash means to study or investigate, and it's a collection of early Jewish commentaries, all the way to the Bayerian and up through the Midrash. What they consider was their best commentators, and it's the primary source for a good percentage of the English commentators and their interpretation of a lot of areas of words, word study, background material, and that type of thing. A lot of it's translated into English. We don't have any of it. Not something to use that often, but some Chino press puts it out. They put out a lot, it's a Jewish publication company that puts out a lot of that stuff, inherently satellite. Anyway, it's just a source for a quotation. Sometimes they'll quote manuscripts that don't exist any longer, so they have to put it in. And then in the Talmud, a lot of these Old Testament stories there. These are sources that go back to the Court of Madrid text and all of these ideas. Sources, I guess, the title of the Court of Madrid text, which is quotations, they're not direct sources, but they're quotations. And the writings of the early Syriac, Greek, and Latin fathers, such as Jerome. What we had in English in the 19th century is probably several times earlier than that. Probably less than the total. Okay. Now on that chart, on the back of file 5, the closer you get to the original autograph, the most adopted text, the original text, the more it's valued for critical purposes, potential critical analysis, that's the rule. Up on the top here, where this is the Masoretic line, the text is Sophron, and then that splits down into the Tiberian and the Babylonian extension. And then out of each of those, we have the various manuscripts of the Babylonian system. Remember, under Sennacherib, he died out, and there's only a few fragments left that relate to that manuscript. What we have is the Oriental manuscripts, basically, the Occidental were later, they're more than. The party to Spain, Portugal, and that area, which are 14th century manuscripts. The printed edition, starting with the 1500, 1525, or the Masora, don't know what the grace is needed for that. I don't know what's coming up. I suspect probably a concert, And with the sheet on it, it breaks down to these various editions of it, and including the Arabic version. So, the sheet itself, that's something that it's based on the Masoretic text. And then Aquila's work to make it Theodosian, Quintus, Septimus, and Origen. These were all additions, later additions of the Septuagint, but they compared it with the Masoretic text. So they used the Septuagint here instead of actually the Greek version. Okay, and then Jerome, the late cardinal, you can include the Dead Sea Scrolls. And another citation, and Theadia, which was a Jewish mystical commentator, he was kind of a Jewish friend of the Lord. He did quote a lot of the Old Testament. A lot of his work is translated. So these were all based on the text of Tolkien. We're all down at the bottom of the Septuagint, the Greek version of the original Septuagint, which is impossible to construct. The unrevised text of that, an Origen's effort, we believe, wound up to a degree anyway in A.D. and Alex and Chesapeake and Huxley. So that's our best source for the Septuagint. And they had various influence on various people. And here you've got the Alexander's father's Coptic version, the Ethiopian version. That's why these are limited value, because they're based on the work that was questioned. Also, the old Latin, before Jerome and Josephus, were based on the Septuagint. Then we've got the Sumerian carving and citation in the New Testament that stand by themselves. And in this group also, we come to the Dead Sea Scrolls. But then really, the value for us, besides the Septuagint, for the most part, is the Masoretic text. Of course, and after that would probably be the Septuagint, the American Tennessee, and all the Tennessee, of course, where the citation are in the Testament. But there, it's really not as much value as you think, because it could be changed in the New Testament. Aquila, where his word survived, probably the best that you can find in the book. They support other versions over the Masoretic text. That would add weight to that. We'll get into that with the evaluating the evidence and how you can use it when we get to the end of the tutorial section. So rather than trying to go through all of it now, how to use it, and hold on to it. But I just wanted to bring all of it in one picture on paper so you can see where it all fits in. And then if somebody asks what this is, we've got a chart here that I'll give you some of the basics. Rather than jump into the store, I got the camera. kind of talk a little bit about the origin of Hebrew, the Hebrew language. But then we get into the Torah. I'm not familiar with the Torah. And the Torah, I wasn't presented halfway through the Torah when we got into certain aspects of the Torah, but there's so much material I'd rather give it by itself, and then also might answer some questions on that line. A lot of it is where I've reconstructed speculation. I'll tell you what I'm speculating is where it's pretty well pinned down. The first, it's not a file number, but it's a copy of the copy that I wrote to the file. It's a two astrological chart here. One is the European languages. It's pretty accurate, except in the very center where it says the original Indo-European mother tongue, which I doubt ever existed. As far as once you get out beyond the inner circle there, they break down pretty accurate. And on the Semitic, on the next page, Semitic languages, the only thing that's not on there is Eblite, and the new find that they discovered the city of Eblon. They've got another whole branch of language to contend with, and it's older than anything that they've found in the chart. So where they stick it should be real interesting. You know, it could be the origin of most of it, or it could be just another branch. I've got some speculation on that. But I just put red light at the top, the question mark, because I'm not really not sure how it goes. If it was on the top, they would have liked the next page. The first page is really, since they're both together, I didn't want to cross this one, so I would have given you this a few seconds. But this way, the advantage of having both together. So you might want to write on one of these. There's I tried to find an explanation that simplifies from a conservative point of view. It's very difficult. But Unger's Bible Dictionary, page 464, 465, give about the best conservative point of view. It's really good point of view. And he's an archaeologist and conservative and recent work, so without with the exception of Emma, which occurred after he wrote the book, which would have really good information, I think. The other one is on the New Bible Dictionary, he gives a chart under the heading of writing. That's on page, in the current edition, it's on page 13, 46, and 47. Yeah, Douglas New Bible Dictionary. I'll show you what the chart looks like. It's really interesting because it shows you the ancient alphabet of the Semitic and the Greek language and our alphabet on the right. You can see the comparison in the different hieroglyphics right across the line in all of the letters. So I wanted a copy of the maybe I can get a copy of that one. It won't fit on one of these, unfortunately, on those sheets. But at least that'll be give you a cross reference for this and what I'm going to talk about in a minute. File 3, the other handout I just gave you. This is the latest series. And I've added a few speculations to it based on everything I've read and based on not much speculation with that, with the exception of the Eblite language. And I put an asterisk. This is a copy out of the chart. It's a copy out of Landon's Introductory Hebrew. LMP. Anyway,
thank you. Pardon?
right behind you, there, Bob, that great book.
What?
Top shelf.
Oh, top shelf.
Yep.
Land, that's land in the
end. Yeah, L-A-N-D, yeah. And that's probably the... See, this is the latest, the main theory of the scholars anyway. And it's pretty accurate as far as once you get down to the Hebrew and the rest of the speculative. Well, I put an asterisk here. It's possible that the headlight was the prototype of both Phoenician and New Greek, because it's a much older and undoubtedly an effective theory of the light. I summarized some things on that handout I wanted to read, but not to go through, but some of the things you're seeing, but I've used a little bit of comparison with that. There's one change here, down in the last paragraph where it says Hebrew, parentheses, Hebrew script, second line. Should be old. Everybody find that? Not print. Okay. So then, the reason I'm going into this is because when you get down to where the square letters came from, then you have to go back to this and start over, because it's kind of like trying to get it in the back. When you get into the measurement of the Torah and start talking about letters to add and square letters, without this background, it's kind of hard to follow this. And also, since some of you are taking pieces, I think they're not probably the Egyptian hieroglyphics combined with Hebraic to be ready for me. That's why it could be separate, but it looks like they would have a lot of things in common. And they used to believe that, currently believe, I should say, that the Ugaritic Phoenician languages, which are Canaanite languages, is a result of their dialect interacting with the Egyptian hieroglyphic system, where you have no vowels, you just have pictures, and they constantly go on and got the language alphabet from that. That's the oldest alphabet anyway, the Phoenician alphabet. And what you learn in English is that's the early alphabet is now they don't know where, because Eblai existed at the same time Egypt and Babylon were in power, and their language gave the big back to the Egyptian So Eblai either evolved separately or as a reaction between the Egyptian and the old Babylonian language, K-A-K-K-A-B-I-A-N. This is as far back as archaeology goes. We don't get back to the Bible. This is as far back as it goes. So, as far as they're going, you've got three world powers. You've got Egypt, Babylon, and Ephraim, and that part of the world.
We talked about the library, Islamic Arab, what scripture we're talking about. I mean, Ur? The library is Ur?
No, Ur is. Urs and Babylon. This is Ezra.
No, I mean, it was what script? I was just trying to figure out what script they used
in Ur. There were several dialects in Babylon. The Akkadian is the oldest. And in Abraham's time, there was a form, I can't recall the name right now, but it's very similar to Aramaic. And Aramaic is a branch. Most likely of Ebla. The Ebla, Babylon at one time was a vassal state of Ebla. And so that language spread into that area.
at a later date, but Acadian was already in that area where they came from, nobody knows. You get back in where they're just speculating. But the language of Abraham in his time was different from the Acadian, the older language. So when he migrated, to Iran, they probably spoke a dialect very similar to them. But that's not the issue. Now, Ugarit and Phoenician are branches of the Canaanite language. Okay, they're very, very similar. They're just one north, one south of the entire side area that was really to the south. Now, Abraham, when he came to Canaan, undoubtedly adopted the Phoenician or the southern Canaanite language. The Ugaritic and the Phoenician, the only difference is one north and one south. It's very slightly. Okay. Now, they know that because of the excavations that they've done. Whatever language that Abraham came with, which is uncertain, except it later became Aramaic, and it was probably very similar to the Aramaic of the
experience, but an early form of Aramaic, possibly somewhere between Aramaic and Hebrew, real close. So when we came from Haran into Canaan, that mixed with Phoenician, which is a southern branch between the islands. Sometimes it does these things. But really, Canaanite, Ugaritic, and Phoenician are almost synonymous. There's a little slight difference between the north and south, kind of like northern and southern pronunciation. And this reason I mention that is because later, you see that the one influenced the northern tribes more, and the other influenced the southern tribes more. So where we see where they. We're talking about the death of somebody with the shibboleth, whatever they pronounce that. That was probably the result of some of these languages in two different areas of space. And it influences the alphabet somewhat too, because when you've got one letter that has two sounds, and another you have one letter and four sounds, and later they were all combined into one letter. So it gets a little bit complicated, but I think Ezra came to the rescue, but we'll get to that.
Okay, Ugaritic is the north.
Ugaritic is the north, and Phoenician is the south. Together they're called Canaanite. Sometimes some books just refer to the north as Canaanite, but basically, in Isaiah, I think it's 1908, I'll have to double check that. The Bible never refers to Hebrew, and it calls it the land of the west. But undoubtedly, from what they uncovered, that this old Hebrew likely what the variation of what Moses wrote in, and that changed with the period of the change, somewhat to David and Solomon's time, but not Moses. They found scriptures back, and very little change up to that point. After the splitting up of the tribes, then you get into differences in language and their influence. They got more and more influence by the pagan nations around them, the language changed. And when the northern tribes went into captivity, the Assyrians imported people into that area. They brought with them Aramaic as it was spoken in the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire, the form of Aramaic there is designated as official Aramaic as opposed to the Aramaic that was spoken earlier. I know this is a teacher. I don't know how to. There's so many different forms of Aramaic, and you see Aramaic because it's kind of like a catch-all phrase. But official Aramaic is what was used by the Syrian king as a refinement of old Aramaic. But this continued to be the language of Babylon. They conquered Babylon. It was the language of Palestine and the Assyrian Empire. The Babylonian branch became Chaldee. Okay, which is what Ezra, Daniel, the parts of Ezra, the parts of Daniel. Okay, so at this point now, we've got Chaldee, the Chaldees have been evolved in Babylon. We've got official Aramaic, there's differences that are almost nil, that evolved in the Palestine area because of all of the Aramaic speaking people that were reported into the area. Okay, is that clear to that point?
One more thing. So when Israel, the other tribes, were being captured, and they transported people back into Israel, they spoke what is called the official Aramaic language. then, since Assyria was the main power at that time, and they conquered Babylon, and you had Assyria, Israel, and Babylon all speaking that Aramaic, and then the Babylonian branch was called Chaldee.
Duval.
Yeah.
You can't call Chaldee because they came from Chaldee and they came back.
So then when Ezra came back, the people of the land no longer knew the old Hebrew. This is apparent from the fact that he had to interpret the scriptures for them. And remember, these were the scriptures for whatever wasn't destroyed in the temple, that they kept separate from Babylon. People can no longer understand what they're
doing. I have a question. If they did not, if you're talking to somebody, if they didn't speak the old Hebrew, and those that went into Babylon, they might pick up the Chaldean language. But what about the people that stayed?
Well, all the people probably spoke the same, but the scriptures were written in the old Hebrew. So for him to read these scriptures, people living in the opposite, even in 70 years, 50%, they're looking at a massive change in that short period of time. Right? So they couldn't understand the old Hebrew book. They didn't understand the temple. So I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Okay, so after the northern tribes, the southern tribes, they still basically, before they went into Egypt, they still spoke the old Hebrew. But then, when they were taken into
Greece, you don't know how much.
Yeah. Those that were taken into captivity picked up the Chaldean language. And what about
they
those?
Were their children? In 70 years, they were raised. You know, they would have been raised in that language. And that was ordered. They had to
know. What about those that stayed back in the
heavens in the land?
Yeah.
Well, apparently there were so few that they. Over that generation, the next seven generations, and the child was in the
then the majority of them go into Egypt.
Well, some of that's very small, probably. But we know that they probably was a very small percentage of people that, to the degree that people were in the north, around the country.
Those that went into Babylon, they, at the time they went, spoke the old Hebrew. But then after, like, their descendants, and even those after they'd been in Babylon, they go and picked up the Chaldean language. What is, isn't that called Aramaic also?
Yes.
But it's just a different.
Chaldee and Aramaic are the same, because Chaldee is a little more precise term to be referred to the branch of Aramaic. Early Chaldee, other speaking the mountains area, that area. But that's just identified as branch.
But what's the language that the Jews spoke after the combination of the Babylonian language and their language? Different than the
but to the degree there's a difference. Remember, they're real close to the Dutch. Old Hebrew is real close to the North Testament. But that's where there's a gap. And before the square letters came from, the gap, the letters that we have right now, they probably evolved in Babylon in the tribes in an attempt to preserve the language. That's just a guess. I don't know. Nobody knows where the square script came from because it only existed in the Old Testament for a dead people when they uncovered they used to think the Gopher invented it. Then they found the dead people and went back to BC, so they know it existed before. So they used to think it invented it in the first or second century AD. But now it's got square letters that came in somewhere. Okay, nobody knows where. Got a lot of guests.
they came in sometime after the return. That's the first use, anyway, you can go within the system. This is why you get a lot of liberals that try and, you know, the JBCD theory, and they've got other reasons, you know, they've got people returning reconstruction moral conditions, you know, and because they've got square legs. So, all that means to me is that was rewritten. Well, we'll get into that in a minute. What I think is Ezra reconstructed under inspiration. I mean, recopied into the square letters. He had manuscripts from the north, manuscripts from the south, and the prophets of both were different enough to where the people could tell what part of the country he was from. Plus, he had Ezekiel's work and Daniel's work in Babylon. Plus his words that the Lord gave him. I think he gets, you know, he must, the more you get into it, the more you see that he must have had a commandment to re-describe and condemn himself. He reconstructed all. I made a picture here of him, and I'm trying to get to a profile of Ezra the next week, but he had to be inspired, but also he could have faced it with that, too, like that he was doing pronunciation of the name, you know, 18 changes in the text, those are the claims that he made. And they make the next thing in the first century AD, you know, that he just like that. Apparently, he made mistakes, but at the same time, if he was in the group under him, collated all these manuscripts, put them together, at that period of time, it explains all the liberal theories, because he would have used the current language, converting the old Hebrew into the current language, if you know somebody did. That's just the people, because he's the only one, you know, no one has the authority, you know, they have to be a criticism. That he probably, also determined the canon of scripture to that point, probably eliminated all the various languages, a lot of things that Solomon wrote, a lot of things that David wrote that they didn't consider was inspired. And probably formulated concretely a common scripture at that point. They were so liberal before that, they probably undoubtedly a lot of garbage kept in before the time too. And then later, Akiva, remember, we're talking about 80 AD, he forbid anybody to use the old Hebrew anymore. He had to use the square letters. But the old letters continued right on into the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the biblical Hebrew became square letters that were instituted after the exile sometime, probably the Babylonians. That's my idea. Now, I'm going to show you some reasons for the biblical profile of Ezra. The reasons why I think that he said that's the kind of trigger. If you get a chance to look at the comments, look at the data, that new Bible dictionary, that chart, it may make a little bit of a difference. Go through if you have any questions. I've got about another 10 minutes to go on that, and then we'll get a little profile of Ezra, and then we'll be in the door and get it up. Very good. Hopefully by next Wednesday we law that he did, he did for 28 years, he did stuff like the tree test with him and how the tree goes.
Is that right?
He was, you know, doing the most righteous thing.
That is really tough.
Problem is, yeah.